And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. Well, here we are, Patty Quatro. It is the end of season three about all things the Pleasure Seekers. Can you believe it? Can you believe
we're here? Oh my God. No, I can't believe we're finally here.
46 extraordinary episodes, if I do say so myself. But before we start, there are a couple things, because I always like to correct the historical record, that I misspoke about in the previous episode. And I had said that the tickets at the Black Arts Festival were $500 each, when of course I meant $5. See why decimal points really matter here.
Oh my God.
I also mentioned in the previous episode that one gig was in 1967, which is not true because everything in the previous episode was 1969. And I also mispronounced one of the artists on the bill with you, and his real name is Anton LaVey. I pronounced it Levy, which was completely wrong. It's Anton LaVey. And thank you, Tommy Kovac of Splat from the Past, for letting me know that I didn't pronounce this correctly. He and I have a personal joke about this, but I won't bore all of you with that. But Tommy, I really do appreciate you calling me out on this. And Patty, you and I had such a blast talking about this third season on his podcast.
Yes, we had great fun being guests on his shows, and he definitely knows his music. So it was always good.
He knows his music, and I love that he's a fan of our podcast, because he's really, really a great guy and he's really smart. Well, I've said this from the beginning on since episode one, and have continued to say throughout this entire third season, that the story of the Pleasure Seekers, from your Patty Quatro, your epiphany at the age of 16 years old at a Beatles concert in 64, through the many band lineup changes, from the personal to the professional, family issues, boy troubles, marital splits, conflicts with record labels, and your image as an all-female rock band versus the suits image of you as either Donna Reed's or a topless act or both, maybe in their wildest dreams. The huge shifts in the country and especially Detroit for you, being a Detroiter, due in part to the racism, the riots, and the Vietnam War, and so much more. All while the Pleasure Seekers' music was first and foremost to attain your goal of being the first girl rock band to make it to the top, and you were so close, and you were ascending and ascending like any good fairy tale would. And under your phenomenal leadership as the founder of the band, this all happened, Patty. It really, really happened. And so quickly, from the moment you started, it was magical. But this fairy tale isn't over yet, my dear. So, Patty, on the previous episode, you shared with us the true backstory to the Black Arts Festival at Olympia in Detroit in 69, Halloween night, and you had some additional info since we last recorded to add in. So you spoke to your brother, Michael Quatro, again, who was still equally as mad as he was the last time you spoke about this. And you also spoke to your sister, Nancy Quatro. So tell us what you want to add to this.
I definitely want to do a wrap up. I'm going to do it again. For sure, the Black Arts had its issues from every corner, and everyone got their panties in a wad for reasons factual and unfactual. So much was written incorrectly as a target piece on Mike and later retracted. If you spoke to 10 to 50 people, you would get various different versions of the festival even today, and the feelings will always be raw. Mike told me, "It hurt me inside because I felt like I was trying to do something for the good of the people and music rather than something bad, and the media targeting me like an anti-hero. And if you really want to get down to it, I can think of various times when I personally gave money to a band so that they could eat. And, I would skip a payment of my own." So the press targeting him and ripping him a new asshole with so much incorrect and skewed reporting really hit him hard, even with the retractions made later on a back page. Facts: Timothy Leary did appear, and they yanked him off stage after 15 minutes. Ted Nugent's lead was unplugged, and he was furious. Other bands on the roster did, in fact, play, and some were not allowed to go on. And ignoring the contract, Mike was left alone, putting out a plethora of fires and venue complications while trying to keep the festival on track. John Drake of the Amboy Dukes sounded in. He was full of respect, as were many other bands that Mike always put his homeboys on these platforms, helped them with record deals, always got them paid. They got paid. In the end, all these homeboys, the fans, and the press kept right on enjoying all Mike's many festivals for years. They had no freaking trouble coming back for more, and that speaks volumes. In reality, to close, Mike did way more than his part in a decade to build up the music reputation and legacy that Detroit has forever enjoyed in the music arena. So for me and my family, kudos to my brother Mike for all his damn hard work.
Amen to that, sister. I completely agree with you. I am, even though I consider myself a sister from another mister with you and your family, I am so defensive of him because of everything that he has done. And so I just want to clarify something because this is still people get this wrong. So in the article, the first hit job that you talked about in the Detroit Free Press that we read from, it was said that the plug was pulled during Savage Grace's performance, but that's not true. It was Ted Nugent's performance, and that's why he was so pissed. Am I correct? Wow, that's incredible. Well, I just want to say on an aside, and we will continue to talk about your brother in season four, but it was so interesting because we are still on season three. That when I did some marketing for us on the previous episode, and I said, is there anybody out there who was at this performance who wants to share stories? And the only response I got was somebody sending me that hit piece by that Julie Morris lady where it's completely wrong. And I thought, wow, so many decades later, and we're still, that story is sticking. So let's make it a personal mission that we're going to make sure to crack open that truth and make sure we get it out there. So,
God.
but this event in a way continued. So a couple of weeks later, after this Halloween event, again in 1969, you're now at a performance and you're not playing there, you're attending a performance, if I'm getting the story right, but I want to hear from you. You and your sister Nancy Quattro. And you're not at Olympia, you're at the Grandy Ballroom. But these are all venues that people, the same fans are frequenting, the same homeboys are playing, acts are headlining. And so tell us what happened at the Grandy in November of 69.
Oh my God. So after the Black Arts, right, and the press piece, Mickey was on the bill at the Grandy Ballroom a couple weeks later. The MC announced the lineup, and some guy in the audience was shouting shit immediately about Mike and the Black Arts. The catcalls began. Sister Nancy and I just happened to be there to see him play, and we grew visibly agitated. With us knowing the entire ins and outs of all the different corners that things that had happened at the Black Arts, Nancy walked up to the loudmouth, pulled out her trademark machete, and held it to his neck as he's standing up, telling him to shut the fuck up. She said to me, "Go on stage and take the mic," which I did immediately. She didn't even have to ask me twice. Grabbing it from the stoned MC, and I was full of spit and vinegar. I announced myself and Nancy, even sarcastically. I started out, "I'm Patty Quattro, Quattro, and this is my sister Nancy." I mean, really sarcastic to the loudmouth. And I told them, "Shut the fuck up and listen to me." And to paraphrase it all, I said, "You're so quick to throw trash. And a lot of it is BS. Olympia didn't give a shit about the contract and stopped some bands from going on, or cutting them off, or pulling other mischief and mayhem as the key holders to the venue. They said, you kids had enough fun and could go the hell home before the contracted curfew hour. So you can just think about that," as I pointed to them all. When you are at many more upcoming next festivals Mike puts on for you to all enjoy. And please make no mistake, you all have no freaking clue how much work is involved to make these festivals come off for your music enjoyment. Dead silence ensued. I left the stage. Peace out.
Peace out, but you are iconic, my dear. You are such a rock star. I am telling you.
I can't believe I told off an audience.
Well, and let's add to the scene that your sister Nancy is standing there holding a machete to somebody in the audience. Okay, so that's my question for you. I mean, I love when you say her Nancy's machete, like as if that's the most normal thing in the world. So that was part of her wardrobe, or did she come prepared with a machete? Please elaborate on that.
No, the machete had become like her trademark item. She loved it. I don't know where she got it. Somebody gave it to her or something, but she used to wear it on her hip. And we didn't come for a fight. We came to support Mike. Nothing more. But she had it on her hip.
She had it on. That too is iconic. Wow, you Quattro, Quatro girls. So I do want to clarify something because we know that your brother Michael was just a leader in putting on these concerts and festivals. But when you say you were there to see Mike, he was also a phenom on the piano and he was a performer.
Yes.
So he was there. Okay, just to clarify that. Okay. So let's talk about Nancy Quattro for a second because I still have stars in my eyes that she wore a machete. And so that what that tells me, unless but you tell me, because she was your kid sister, is your kid sister, that she was a real rebel and that she was 16 at this point in the Pleasure Seekers, right? And but she had already been dating Ted Nugent since she was 15. Now I wonder, we have to ask her this when she's on. I wonder if Ted Nugent had anything to do with the machete look, if you will, because he's
No.
such a hunter. No, that was her and her
No,
own.
I don't think he had anything to do with it. Nancy was the baby of the family. She was the only one left home alone, and she was a hellraiser in her own way. Already, she was dressing goth early on and making it clear where her tastes were headed as she entered the sisters' band and
Well,
her.
hold that thought, because that's actually what I wanted to tease out. If she's 15 years old going to high school as a goth, that's 2 decades before I'm going to school as goth.
She was
And
dressed
that's 2 decades
up.
before goth became goth. That's an
I know.
regret. Again, machete, goth. She's incredible. Keep going.
She's hilarious. In fact, she got to know Ted a lot because, the home bands would hang out at his house a lot. It was like a meeting place. And the relationship began. They just got to know each other. So they were dating. And in fact, there was a hellacious car chase story as Nancy had climbed out of her window in the middle of the night to be with Ted, and Dad caught her sneaking out.
So she's still living at home at this point.
She's living at home. Well, yeah, we all were when we were home,
True.
And Dad caught her in the act. He jumped into his own car to catch them, and a crazy car chase ensued all over town. And I'm sure she'll get into the detail in the future as she elaborates. It was quite a scene all over, speeding through the town.
Oh, I love that visual. It's fantastic. And I love that it's in a car. And this is the Motor City. All of our pillars coming back together as we're saying goodbye on the season. It's amazing. Well, I do
My
want to
God.
talk about something else. So speaking of dating, we had mentioned how your older sister, Arlene, was making up for lost time after her recent divorce from your now old manager, Leo Fenn.
Yes.
And Leo and Arlene had gotten married very young at 18, right out of high school, and had 3 kids. And so Leo is still booking you guys. We talked about this with your brother, but you now described Arlene, and I just again, the visual is hilarious. She was like a kid with all these new toys, boy toys, as I call them. And
Yes.
but it was, and she just was having so much fun reliving this youth that she never had. But she also, during this moment in time, very quickly falls in love and starts to seriously date a guy named Kenny Moore, who was younger than Arlene. He was also from Detroit. He was
Yeah.
very good looking and he was a budding fashion designer. So what do you remember about Kenny Moore coming into the scene here?
As you described him, yes, Kenny Moore was a sweet, personable and terrific man. They were crazy about each other as it moved along. He was very focused on his designing career and often back and forth between New York City and Detroit. She was still dating around. However, Kenny really began to grab her interest seriously.
Well, you and I talked about this privately, and I want to see if I'm correct in this assumption that, yes, we've talked about Arlene dating, right? Because she wanted to relive a youth she didn't have. But you were saying to me privately that it wasn't that Arlene was necessarily wanting to play the field because it was the hippie era and free love. It was because she was seeking that one true love. And it sounds like, tell me if I'm wrong, like Kenny Moore was becoming the one. And if so, was this new relationship with Kenny affecting the band at all?
Well, to make a point of it, Arlene was definitely coming of age in the band in her way. She was not suddenly dating around as much. She stopped hanging with Susie so often, not even going out with us as much. She was devoting more time to Kenny now. And you know, you got to remember, she did have a natural sexiness. However, as you said, she had never been savvy or streetwise, and often the heady and pushy male attention turned her off. And we saw that Kenny was a welcome change at this point, and we were all happy for her. And yet, my bandleader brain was coming to realize there would likely be more spinning wheels to contend with as Arlene was grappling with her new situation with Kenny.
Grappling, to clarify, because she's head over heels. And so grappling of how to pursue this while still being in a band.
Yes.
And it sounds like the choice was going to be very obvious, that it was going to be Kenny. And so, as you said, your spinning wheels, your brain, band leader Pat, were you and your other sisters, Nancy and Susie, also in the band, talking about this? Was this out in the open?
Well, you know, what happened was it came up at the Florida gig, that last one. The owner had been full of ego and terribly pushy to a bad degree with Arlene and not leaving her alone. So it happened pretty quickly after that. She came to feel she was head over heels in love with Kenny. She wanted to make a future with him and her kids and leave the band. She even detailed her momentous decision in a letter to our fan club president, Kathy. She was confident in her decision. She didn't waffle at all. And then quickly, she was indeed out of the band. And we sisters, we weren't slow tops, and the writing had been on the wall. And she had let us know, and to be honest, we were already in our percolating ideas of how to handle yet another change for the band. And always with Art's voice in my ear, get back on that horse. No one is irreplaceable.
Oh, you're a wonderful father, Art. That's incredible. Well, I have to say, and this really sounds terrible of me, it doesn't surprise me that Arlene would fall head over heels with a guy and hitch her wagon to him, so to speak. It
Yeah.
surprises me that she now wanted to be at home as almost a stay-at-home mom of very small kids. Now, again, that sounds terrible of me because she's their mom, but it sounds like Kenny Moore really had a huge impact on her.
He did, because, I mean, like I said, she was coming of age in her own psyche. She was realizing that there might be something more in her life than appears Kenny, you know. So, yeah, she went through a transformation right then and did feel the value of maybe leaving the band, being with her kids finally, and all of that. And she gets Kenny, too, you know. So, I mean, you know, she was a pretty happy chick.
It's another version of this fairy tale magic. I love it. So you knew that Arlene was going to be out, and you did have a few dates, gigs left with her. But by December, you're saying 1969, Arlene Quattro is out of the Pleasure Seekers. So, however, though, before she's out, you, the four sisters, played as the Pleasure Seekers at some final gigs and jams in Chicago.
Yes.
But you've told me we don't have any photos or press for this, right?
Not a bit. No pics, no press, no time. Just more spinning wheels to contend with, getting through the interim last gigs with Arlene and resolving what was next for us during this holiday season.
Well, and no time is absolutely spot on because I just want to remind the listeners, you have already had to deal with multiple changes in the pleasure seekers, not even going back to 64. I'm talking within the few months, a short amount of time. You had Darlene Arnone on drums was out. You had Nancy Rogers come in to replace Darlene. And then Nancy Rogers was out, and Susie Quattro, your sister, went back to the drums.
Oh.
Nancy Quattro comes in to add additional vocals. And remember Lily Weaver, our wonderful Lily Weaver, your
Yeah.
costumer, she's out as well. And
Yeah.
Leo Fenn is out. So,
Yeah.
and it's just incredible. So during this time, you're all still in Detroit. And Patty, you do have, I love this story so much. It's still 1969. It's November 13th. You have a hilarious story about the Jefferson airplane who came to play in Detroit. So tell us, set the stage.
Oh my God. Yes, that fall was a flurry of gigs here and there, Chicago, Black Arch, Home Hanging, seeing other homeboy bands, Alice Cooper, The Who, SRC, Ted Nugent. It was a mix of in-town fun and out-of-town gigs. And one jam night, I remember so damn well. November 13, 1969, the Jefferson Airplane played Detroit. We're not on the bill, but we went to see them. After the gig, Yorma and Jack Cassidy on bass joined us at the Quattro Rehearsal Garage, which was a normal event at the Quattro House. Picture it. Parents asleep inside at the other end of the house. The boys on acid. We're jamming in the middle of the freaking night, and suddenly the door squeaks open. And there's my dad in his boxer shorts, skinny white legs, standing there observing us. The boys stop mid-strum with their breaths. I mean, they're holding their breaths, well stoned. And dad says, "Oh, do you boys know B flat blues?" And he proceeds into the garage to jam with us and finally goes back into sleep later. We are well mortified, but the guys thinking is cool as hell. They stay till 6:30 a.m. with Jack trying to talk Susie into coming back to the hotel. She declines, and they leave with mom's chocolate chip cookies. They also compliment our version of White Rabbit. I think we jammed on it for a minute. And in later years, the funny part is Yorma would come to our LA home because my husband still handled him in Hot Tuna and all that. And he would come for our kid's birthday, and he never let me forget that jam night, thinking Dad Art had been the epitome of cool. In what universe do these things happen?
Oh, I just, your father, I hold such a soft spot for him. He is so cool, so funny, so in a way embarrassing. He's such a dad, but he's also so hip and cool. I love that story. Well, it was only soon thereafter. So this was November 13th and now November 24th. Couple of weeks later, your brother Michael Quattro promotes and brings into town none other than the Rolling Stones. And as a reminder, he'd been booking gigs, including the Rolling Stones, since about 1964. And as part of his booking agency, as we talked about with the Black Arts Festival, this included him owning his own limo that
Yes.
would be used to pick up the music acts arriving at the airport. So first, Patty, tell us about your brother's limo.
God.
And how he would park it and all of that, and then tell us about anything you want with the Rolling Stones.
Okay, well, here we go with his limo's day in the sun. His limo had been used often with him and my dad picking up bands as necessary. And it would not fit all the way into his garage, right? Which bothered him. So, in his out-of-the-box thinking, he actually proceeded to cut a wall out in his den wall, and he made a cabinet to fit the hole. Thus, now the limo could fit into the newly constructed space. I remember Mick Jagger got quite a kick of how Mike has solved the limo issue. Who would do this but Mike?
Oh, that is hilarious. I want to hear more about you going to pick them up, but I have to interject here that your brother Mike took me by his house on Mac, where this house was, and he showed me where the hole was. Obviously, the
Oh
new
my
owners
God.
have fixed it, but I laughed so hard because it's not subtle. It's at the front of the house.
It's great.
So how did it work out that you're now taking your brother's limo to go pick up the Rolling Stones? How did that even come about? I want to hear anything you remember.
Probably Dad was with us, or Mike, I'm not sure. But we picked them up in the limo. It was very tight security. I couldn't believe it. I was surprised at how quiet they were, keeping pretty much to themselves. I didn't expect that. They did not hit. They did not flirt on us, which was different from so many other bands we always interacted with. You know, there was always the hit factor. And I remember thinking them very short, too. Of course, in saying that, I'm real tall. So, you know, Mike ended up traveling with them to Frisco and LA gigs later. The gig went real well. It was an experience. But yeah, they were pretty damn quiet.
Quiet, but they obviously put a lot of faith and trust into your brother, Mike. Well, you just mentioned that you're very tall and that they're very short. And there is somebody now that we're getting to the tail end of this third season.
Here we go. Oh my God.
We put a pin on this in the last episode, but I finally get to ask you, or at least start to ask you, about one of the guys in your personal life and professional, but in this case, personal. And we've teased this out now for many episodes, but it's none other than Sir Roger Daltrey. And he is what is shorter than you, but you were saying, telling me privately, that he was not as short as the Rolling Stones guys, that they were remarkably short.
Yeah, they felt like it to me. Yes, they just seemed small.
Well, a reminder to the listeners who may not have heard the episode about this. It was Detroit is Burning, I believe, or the one after that. But it was when the Pleasure Seekers first met the Who in '68 at the Gorham Hotel in New York, when they were playing at a gig separate from you, and the Pleasure Seekers were playing at Trudy Heller's. And a reminder, this is when Darlene Arnone was on drums. The band did a version of My Generation. And so the Who wanted to come see that. And so you may also remember, yes, it is Detroit Burning, that on this night that you hung out with the Who at the Gorham and also the Blues Magoos, it was the night after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. So this is April 1968. And so it's a fantastic episode. Go back and listen to it. But in a nutshell, the country is on high alert, and leave it to the Blues Magoos and Keith Moon, or Mooney as you call him from the Who, decide to set off firecrackers outside. And again, it's a really wild episode, but I mention it here because that was your first time meeting Roger. Am I correct on that? Or why don't you just make sure I'm getting all of this chronology right? Because you're going to meet him again in Cradle. But before you answer that, my dear, I want to read from none other than Sir Roger Daltrey's own autobiography, and it's called Thanks a Lot, Mr. Kibblewhite. So he does a chronology here, and again, I want you to correct it, clarify it, whatever. So this is now in Roger's own words, and he's referencing Keith Moon. This is now back in 1967, but this is in Flint, Michigan, not Detroit. And so Roger Daltrey says, quote, "On August 23rd, 1967, in Flint, Michigan, Keith Moon turned 21. He chose to mark the occasion by getting us banned from every Holiday Inn on the planet, and I wasn't even there. I'd seen him in the morning and he was already pissed, so I decided to spend the rest of the day in the company of a talented, beautiful guitarist called Patty Quatro." Close quote. So, Patty, I'm now blushing and so are you. So, Patty, what do you remember about this August 23rd, 1967 gig in Flint? And the reason why I ask is because 1 year later is when you will meet him at the Gorham in '68 again. So what are you willing to share with us, Patty Quatro?
Well, August 23rd, actually 1967, Flint, Michigan was a well-documented gig the Who did on tour with the Herman's Hermits, where a wild birthday party for drunken Keith Moon happened with a lot of hotel damage done. Scott Richardson was there of SRC. He was very close with the band, as was I. Roger Daltrey wanted to steer clear of the mayhem Keith was doing at this wild party. So I met him. We stayed well apart from it. We are getting along great. This was actually the first time Roger and I met. He did not want to be around Keith.
Okay, well, I think that's all fantastic, but I don't care about Keith right now and whether he wanted to be around Keith. I want to hear about you and Roger, as he's calling you, this talented, beautiful lady. So, what did you do when you were hanging out?
Oh my gosh. I think we spent some time in his hotel room visiting and getting to know each other. I mean, it was the first time. He was even looking differently at that time. He had his shorter hair. He didn't have his beautiful golden locks yet, So it was a different look, but they were making their way up the music ladder and doing very well. So, I was real happy to meet him and visit.
Okay, you're killing me here. What does visit mean? What did you do in the
Ah,
hotel room? I am literally
basically,
gonna beat it out of
Preston,
here.
nothing happened on that visit.
Okay.
You'll put a pin in that one. Oh my God, you are so bad.
Well, I will put a pin in it because, as you just said, his curly little locks, that's going to come back into play
Oh
when
yeah.
you're in Cradle and you're in the fourth season. So again, putting a pin in it, but thank you for sharing. Well, I really, speaking of Cradle, I am so excited. You and I have so much to get to with Cradle in season four, but we still have a lot to get to with the Pleasure Seekers, knowing it's going to disband as it was because of Arlene leaving. And this is still the last few weeks of 69, including, again, what you decided to do with your sister Arlene's departure. So tell us, band leader Pat, all about this, as well as that there was going to be another lineup change about to occur because of Susie. So tell us anything you want about these next changes.
Okay. Well, first of all, we again had a connection October 11 through 14, 1969, during this. And the Who did gigs in Detroit with Alice Cooper on the bill. And we all hung with Alice, SRC, MC, and the Who. And by now, Roger and I had a cool connection. Still waiting for that pin to hit in Cradle. But we did not play with the Who, and our many connections were more hanging in private time, indeed in Detroit, the UK, and so on. So, Kristen, we grew up. We are now young adults, musicians, with our own ideas on how to proceed with Arlene now out. Susie wanted back in front. She missed it. So we decided that Nancy and Susie would share vocal space and keys for when we wanted keys in some songs. So we still traveled with keys. It was the era of three-piece bands exploding. We determined to just use the organ as a sometimes instrument. We were focused on writing more originals and jamming a la trend of what was happening now in the nation. We could have it all and options with two very strong front vocals, very different from each other. The Quatro girls were well capable at this point in keys, vocals, bass, and guitar, credit to lessons and their musical family upbringing. So I called Nancy Rogers as we wanted to bring her back in the band. That was our first thought. We spoke up in her bedroom and she asked right away, "Well, is Pammy going to come back also?" I said, "No, very
Okay,
soon."
wait. Let me just pause here for a second. So Nancy Rogers and Pammy Benford had just been let go so that you could become just the Quattro sisters as Pleasure Seekers. But now that Arlene is leaving, it's just the three Quattro sisters. And so you go to Nancy Rogers to bring her back on drums. And also, as you told me, she was really starting to be very musically experimentative in terms of other instruments. So, okay, go on. So you say to Nancy in her bedroom, or she asks you, should we bring Pammy Benford back in? And you say,
No, firmly. I didn't want to know that episode was done, to be honest. I didn't want the back problems and the stuff. We didn't need two guitars. We felt we had this covered. But it took Nancy only a nanosecond to join with us. It was sad about Pammy, but she had not been happy with her present band at all. Nancy was very attracted to our new direction and indeed a new name as well.
Well, and I want to hear about this new name. It's not like we're giving anything away. It's Pleasure Seekers becomes Cradle. And I love the name Cradle. Not that I don't love the name Pleasure Seekers, but it worked for a moment in time, the Pleasure Seekers. But the name change to Cradle is as Powerful and dynamic as your nervy self, bandleader Pat, bucking the societal norms for women in music, and all for pure desire of wanting to write, create, produce, and perform rock and roll.
Yes. I've said Pleasure Seekers was my heart, and I mean that thoroughly. It was a great name for a young band. It was sexy, it was sassy, it was fun, and it garnered a lot of attention as we started as teens. Then, as everyone does, we came of age too. We grew up. As we grappled with the prejudice with labels and us women being serious musicians, it began to feel a bit too girly of a name. And you know, your motivations and goals can change and grow. And at the end of the Pleasure Seekers days, we wanted a name that brought more gravitas to what we were feeling in our new musical direction. You may find it surprising, Kristen, but honestly, it was not really a huge stretch renaming our band. We usually freaking did what we wanted and felt was best for us. You know this through many years. I guess our Quattro Balls and Confidence DNA always drove us in our decisions. And the cradle name came from thoughts of the cradle of civilization, back to the beginning, knowing yourself, your own mind. We even had a mission line. This was funny. The hand that rules the cradle rocks the world, giving the women the gravitas they deserved. We loved it. It was a unanimous decision. We even designed a cover with Nancy Quattro holding a cradle with a baby in it, right? Holding up a guitar in the air, and the baby's face would be a mirror, like looking in at yourself. Brilliant!
And brilliant.
We did that later on the retro CD. This was now a group of women, the four of us, who were motivated with a huge determination to write meaty lyrics that had something to say and wanting to explore many genres. There was a huge excitement in the air over the holidays.
Well, this is so exciting. Again, I can't wait to get to season four and all things Cradle, but we do have one last original Pleasure song, Pleasure Seekers song to get to, and that is Brain Confusion. I have to say it's probably my favorite, although I love all of your songs. And we are in episode 46 now, but we opened up the first episode of season three by playing Brain Confusion. And in that context, we closed it out with the song because it was to hear how tight the Pleasure Seekers were as a band, all of you, as well as you and your sisters, the harmonies, which are so distinct and so unique and, of course, so beautiful. But as we close out this third season, I think it's a perfect song to listen to for now because we've gotten to know the Pleasure Seekers and this fairy tale from 1964 to 1969. And this includes the stellar and evolving music, as you said, in front of the curtain and all the insider stories you've shared with us and fabulous insights of what it was like during this very chaotic time in terms of the country and the culture and the war and everything. So and what you were going through with the band. So I would like you, Patty Quattro, to give us one more music class on season three. And tell us everything and teach us everything about the song Brain Confusion, the lyrics, the music, the arrangement, the individual playing on it. I will say Nancy Rogers drumming on this is spectacular. Your guitar playing is to die for. But I want to hear it from you. And also, I'm curious, tie this in with why did you, Patty, decide to include Brain Confusion on the Pleasure Seekers retrospective and not Cradle?
Very pointed reasons. Brain Confusion is one of our fans and my fave songs, same as you, and it always has been. It's a hot jazzy boogie with many elements to it. And simply put, I consider Brain Confusion our most important transitional original that completely connects the Pleasure Seekers moving into the Cradle Band and definitely belonged as the last cut on our Pleasure Seeker CD. That was my decision and it worked. Class is now in session. I want you to hear Susie's bass riffs, my leads ending on a high note, the quattro harmonies on full display with an a cappella section, and Nancy Rogers putting a firm foot on the jazzy feeling drums. I want you to hear the era, The new musical trends exploding and enjoy the pure boogie feel of the music. I want you to hear the emotional lyrics of these young girls' voices heard, who had gone through so much push and pull challenges, including the angst and growing pains of our entire generation, right? Along with hard decisions, member changes, and most important, how even within that rough journey for women and women musicians in our era, we still kept our determination to find our own way forward, come what may. And I will say, everything seemed to come our way to deal with. Brain confusion to the max. And a final thought you must remember upon listening. You will hear a live recorded song on a two-track tape machine on a bill with the MC5 on New Year's Eve. It was pure gold that it survived in a closet at the Quattro home and was able to be represented here and on our retro PS CD and vinyl decades later. It shows the quality and tightness of the band in an amazing rendition of the song, raw and live, and so on display here.
Patty, I could just do an entire episode on Brain Confusion. I think this song is so spectacular. I love the harmonies of singing All the Lonely People. That's not just a reference to the Beatles and Eleanor Rigby. There was a band called All the Lonely People, and it really did, as you're saying, it was speaking to everything that was going on, the chaos in the culture. And just to reiterate, this particular version of Brain Confusion did not have Arlene on keys. That's why you didn't hear that. But right. There were many versions and gigs that you did where she was on keys. Yes. That's yes. Correct, right?
Yes, yes. We had done it with Arlene and then without her through Cradle. Many versions exist on tape. We even had a 13-minute rendition jam version in Cradle.
Do you have that?
Yes, I have it.
So we can listen to that on season 4. Woohoo! I can't wait to hear that.
It represents a legacy song for both Pleasure Seekers and Cradle. That's how I feel about it so strongly.
Well, and you had an incredible recognition in terms of your legacy with this song in 2012. Tell us about this.
I have to add this last trivia point. Picture the scene. The Michigan-Detroit Hall of Fame of the 2012 inductions of Pleasure Seekers and Cradle. They did both of us at once, for which we all flew into Detroit. It was a historic, atmospheric theater jam-packed with homeboy bands, fans, old and young rockers. We had the young bands waiting to go on, standing on the stage sides with their mouths hanging open, that with 2 days rehearsal, we pulled off our set of 3 songs in our 60s. We're in our 60s and not having played together for decades and closing our set with a huge standing ovation and photographers and audience pressing the stage. The producer of the show comes up to me afterwards and he says, "I have never seen anything so heartwarming and amazing in the years of doing these induction shows." And that, my friends and fans, is what you can call Detroit magic.
Oh, Patty, you just gave me chills. But wow, I love that this producer said this to you, because, well, I'm sure it's true. I wish I could have been there. I know people that have saw that performance who said their mouths were on the floor, how tight you were. And I have to say, you say that's the magic of Detroit. And I wholeheartedly agree with you. And now that I'm living in Detroit, I get to feel that magic every single day of my life. But I do think in the case of the Pleasure Seekers and the Quattro family, founded by you and your band leading talents, the perseverance of every incarnation of the Pleasure Seekers and this larger fairy tale story you lived out over these years was its own kind of magic. But I don't think you can separate, and we've talked about this before, but I really see it now. You cannot separate the Pleasure Seekers' drive, grit, and determination to be the first all-female band to make it to the top from the drive, grit, and determination in the DNA of Detroit. And as you have said, and I quote you all the time on this, especially here, and every Detroiter agrees with me, you always say, Pat, in Detroit, music was the culture.
Yes.
So as we began this road trip on season 3 with the objective of telling, I was going to call it your biography, but I would say your fairy tale now. But the idea was for you to tell an oral history that was factual, corroborated with evidence versus personal narratives or revisionist history to fit a certain narrative or ego, because your story, your band's story, and of course your family's story is so instrumental, yes, pun intended, to the legacy of music in Detroit. And so with the said, because you have persevered and archive the pleasure seeker's history and music so well. You, Patty, did have the idea of writing your own autobiography. Mm-hmm. And so I have a twofold question for you. The first question is, how did this format as a podcast or an oral history compare to your earlier vision? And we know how brilliant your visions are, or epiphanies, of writing all of this down in a book. And then the second question I have is, you have such an incredible memory and have shared all of these incredible stories with us. But was there anything that you learned on these 46 episodes that you maybe didn't see or recognize because you were so close?
Okay, first of all, I was never one to write a book. For me, this was an audio type journey in chapters or episodes. Give me the real freaking voice. Give me the real emotions in real time audio with accurate history. I want to hear the real feelings behind the journey instead of what can be for me a colder written word that doesn't display those emotions. Audio, okay? And in looking back at our episode seasons, of course, there have been so much recognized memories and even revelations that have given such gravitas that the pleasure seekers experienced in this Renaissance era of rock in a city like no other, Detroit, where you freaking leave it on the stage or go the fuck home. We come of age within the blessings of a musical family and with stellar female musicians and homeboy bands at the inception point of a new musical era. It was so amazing. My God, Kristen, the luck I had to be in it, live it, breathe it. It was truly monumental. It illuminated within us such primal musical ferocity that engaged our talents. Well, I could not have lived a more rewarding life experience in the very satisfying retelling of it in our podcast format episodes. It was like peeling an onion, as you did so well to me, with you always holding my feet to the fire and dragging out accurate stories and events. I truly feel you and me, we together, made the magic happen, warts and all, as it should be.
Oh, I love that. And I didn't know you were going to make me cry.
Burnabout is fair play.
Yes, I guess so. Well, I mean, hearing you tell these stories, I just think this serial podcast is a perfect platform for you because you are wicked smart. You're funny, you're clever, you're reflective, you're insightful. And I do not give this title to many because as somebody having my PhD in history, I don't just say, oh, you're a historian because you've read a lot of books. You, my dear, are a historian. You have the way to use your third eye to widen the lens and not make everything so me-centric when you're telling these stories, these magical stories. And I do think this format's also perfect because we can take away all of these cut and pastes we've talked about and not have things regurgitated over and over again. And I love the fact, and I never have a problem with this, that you and I can correct it, anything we've said from a previous episode, and just make sure it's out there, as opposed to if you had written a book and let's say you said one thing, well, that's out there, and then you can't go back and correct it until there's maybe a second edition. So I just have had so much fun with you doing this, and we still have so much more to get to. But I do have to say bravo to you in terms of how you have handled this podcast platform.
Oh, thank you. This partnership has been such gold for me and for us. We had our little mission statement to stay in the light. Check the freaking ego at the door. And this was such a mission for us. No online cut and paste, no inaccurate revisionist history to serve the ego. It didn't have a place on our journeys. I believe we have stayed the course in our representations, and I'm terribly proud of that.
I am too. I feel we really did live up to our mission statement. And so I just want to do a little, before we end this third season, a little recap of all things the Pleasure Seekers and your legacy. Now, you and I are going to do this again at the end of Cradle in season 4, and then we're going to do an even larger legacy. So this is just a little tip of the iceberg. But so the Pleasure Seekers All of you started in 1964 and had many band lineup changes. And so I'm just going to read through them. Starting in 1964, it was band leader Patty Quatro, younger sister Susie Quatro, Nan Ball, our beloved Nan Ball, Mary Lou Ball, Diane Baker, Chris Wenzel, Sherry Hammerly, Nano's second Sherry, Eileen Bidlingmeyer, Arlene Quatro, Darlene Arnone, Pammy Benford, Nancy Rogers, and your sister, Nancy Quatro. Amazing. And in terms of the Pleasure Seekers legacy and how much your music lives on to this day, I mean,
Wow.
absolutely continues to this day. The band has had many song placements in films or television, whatever. And that includes your song, Mr. Power. And it was in a Canadian TV show, Fortunate Son. Your songs, Gotta Get Away and Locked in Your Love, were also in The Marijuana Conspiracy, which was a film, also Canadian. And it's interesting to think about that they would know your music because you toured there a lot and they
Yeah.
loved you there. So
Yeah.
now, again, geography matters. And then there was a special where they used your song, Locked in Your Love. Your song, What a Way to Die, has had many, many versions done, including Florida Man, which was an episode on Netflix, episode 103. And What a Way to Die was in a film called Sting, which was Australian, not the American film. It was also, the song was in VHS 85, which was an indie horror film. And in 2013, Levi Strauss did an ad with What a Way to Die.
Yeah.
And so, add in anything you want here before I go on.
Oh my God, there have been so many compilations of that original garage punk female beer and drinking song, What a Way to Die. That song still has legs going on and being used in film indies and recordings to this day, as well as being covered by other bands and even on TV and Parenthood, that series. It's such a well-respected representative song of that type. So it just goes on and on.
Well, I mean, it's timeless. It's wonderful. Well, your song White Pig Blues was also covered in an indie film called Subservience.
Yeah.
And there was a Constantine film where they brought in your song Never Thought You'd Leave Me. And that was in 2025. So
Yep,
again,
just
this
now.
continues. And
Yep.
so I've been so curious about this. Tell us about what
It
was
was
Blood Orgy of the Leather Girls.
Oh my God. It was a very cool, campy, horror, full movie theater release in 1988. And they used What a Way to Die in it. I'm determined to locate a copy of it. It's very hard to find, but they say it's going to come out on DVD. All I can offer here is the YouTube trailer, and we'll link it. It's right there on YouTube with the whole trailer thing, and What a Way to Die is the song on the trailer, the whole song.
I have to say, whoever selected What a Way to Die for Blood Orgy of the Leather Girls, it's perfect because the Leather Girls are the ones who are going out and killing people. So What a Way to Die. And then they're like vampires. It's just it's hilarious. It's campy. Yes.
Yes, it is. It is. And when you start compiling a proper PS resume, it could take a long ass time. So, to honor the Pleasure Seeker legacy, I'm going to provide a really quick summary here what Pleasure Seeker enjoyed. Numerous local and national TV shows for years, documentaries that were represented in, awards given, numerous magazines featuring us. 13 books represented in discography with so many labels, endless interviews, radios, podcasts, and we'll touch so much more in Cradle Season. It's been a respectable legacy, and I'm proud of it.
Respectable and also completely over the top amazing. Let's just, I don't know what else to say. And it really, I mean, I keep using this word, but it's another ode to your legacy, but also this fairy tale story that
Yes.
was the Pleasure Seekers. And it's funny because I want to play something which speaks to your legacy. And this was an introduction by a UK DJ named DJ the Lord, or Lordy, as he's called. And before we play this, do you know what this was an introduction for and how it came about?
Yes, DJ, we were friends. He's a UK online DJ, and he's also an engineer, very talented with doing, work on recordings. And he loved our bands, and he offered to write the intro for our retro CD. And we were so he nailed it. It was so well done what he picked to say and write about us. I loved it.
I love it too, and so we're going to play it in full. And so here it is.
Once upon a time, there were four little sisters, named Arlene, Patty, Susie, and Nancy, who dreamed of becoming rock stars. But the nasty adults told them, "You can't become rock stars, darlings. You're little girls and must like Barbie dolls and puppies and blue skies and bar lamps and fluffy clouds and little white picket fences." The sisters sat in their room and thought about this terrible news. There was silence for a long time. Suddenly, the girls looked up in excitement and said,
"Let's kick down some freaking doors!"
Rocking it raw, with edge and attitude, they took over the garage and unleashed their Detroit rock city music on an unsuspecting world. And so it came to pass that the Quattro Sisters started a revolution, setting the stage for women to rock their music hard. Here they are now as the Pleasure Seekers. What a way to die.
Oh, I just love it. And don't you think it's funny that Lordy even picked up on the fairy tale aspect of the Pleasure Seekers by opening up with this once upon a time?
That was his idea. And it was so well written and so fitting for our story, our fairy tale, span of years that we did it. It was all his wording. And he put together a sampler order of songs. He also had that expertise. So whatever order it's in, that's what he thought to do.
Well, I actually checked on that because this is his ordering. It's not like he took the CD retrospective and just went in order. And so his songs that he picked of yours in order is Gotta Get Away, Good Kind of Hurt, Locked in Your Love, Elevator Express, What a Way to Die, Where Have You Gone, Light of Love, White Pig Blues, Never Thought You'd Leave Me, Brain Confusion, and Mr. Power. So, Patty, you are a living legend, and I have been so honored and I'm so humbled to call you my friend, my lifelong friend, my podcast partner in fun in telling your extraordinary fairy tale history. And I'm so, again, grateful for you inspiring me every single day. And yes, keeping me in the light. That's where you held my toes, feet to the fire. And so do you have any final thoughts before we close out this season?
Oh my God, you've already got me pulling out my cradle archives. I can't wait to explore the band that was my soul. And I will say it over and over. Cradle was my soul. Pleasure Seekers was my heart. There is so much more to the story and the music we created. I remain honored and thrilled that with the amazing talents and expertise of my co-podcast partner and historian, Dr. Kristen Hilaire, we were able to steer this fairy tale journey to its very satisfying and accurate conclusion. And with a heartfelt thank you, respect, and love to our supportive fans and friends, I will say Kristen and I cannot wait to illuminate all of what will happen next season of Rock and Roll Survivors podcast. Stay tuned as we transition from Pleasure Seekers into Cradle. Onward to season 4, and let the music and the magic continue.
Absolutely. I love that, Patty. And let the music continue. Let the fairy tale continue, because this story is not over yet. But you're all just going to have to wait. And so until then, my dear, that's a wrap.